listening to Society 13. Do not attempt to adjust your headset. I said, don't adjust your headset.
I said, don't adjust your headset.
Don't adjust your headset!
You're listening to the Society 13 Podcast Network. Don't adjust your headset.
Warning. The Wicked Library contains adult themes, adult situations, adult language, and graphic depictions of terror, bloodshed, the occasional possession, and your future trips to your psychiatrist, so he or she can assure you it's only a story. This podcast is intended for mature audiences only. You've been warned, kiddies.
Hello, kiddies. This is your librarian. What do you get when you take 14 horror writers and put them on the Wicked Library? You get nightmares. Welcome to the Wicked Library's Halloween special.
Happy Halloween, everyone. Welcome to the Wicked Library, and this is the Halloween special. Now, last year when we did the Halloween special, there was no we, it was me. And I was by my lonesome, and I was doing really bad artwork and living out of my car and going through... No, actually, that's not true at all. That's not true at all. But it was essentially just me doing the show last year. And what happened last year was I found three really great old and, most importantly, public domain stories from Edgar Allan Poe and Lafcadio Hearn. And, you know, just it was a fun episode. This year I wanted to do something a little different because we are getting a lot more high profile these days. Go figure that one out. I attribute a lot of the popularity of this show to my silent but ever-present partner, Maddie Von Stark, who was not around, was not involved with the show a year ago. And her handiwork is all over the show these days. She is truly my partner in crime in this endeavor. And we are both writers as well. And really, for this season, for this special, wanted to bring back what the mission statement is. I mean, we did Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven last year. Everyone knows that story. Everyone knows Edgar Allan Poe. Well, there's a clutch of authors that maybe you haven't heard of, or maybe you have heard of and you really dig them and you heard them first on this show. Maybe you've gone out and bought some books that they're in or some novels that they've written. The whole point of the Wicked Library is to promote up-and-coming authors in the horror genre, speculative fiction, whatever you want to call it. It's for independent authors. It's for new guys. Now, we have rather good-named people come on the show, and that's beginning to happen a little more frequently, and it's great because, you know, they're very supportive of what it is that Maddie and I are trying to do here. And we can't thank all of them enough. Joe Lansdale, Daniel Knopf, Gary Bronbeck. There's a list you could ski down. Kind of like this episode. So check out the craziness of this. I put an open call out to some authors and said, hey, send me your shortest short stories. We call it flash fiction. It's under 1,000 words or maybe just a hair over 1,000 words. And I've got 13 killer pieces of work here. And I'm not going to hold up keeping you in suspense, but I'm going to go down the list and then I'm going to play their stories. And I will give you the menu at the end of who wrote what. But we're going to start off with the co-pilot here at the Wicked Library. And her name, of course, as you know, is Maddie Holiday Von Stark. currently Maddie has a 4-chapter preview of her novel, The Widow's Game. And we've done two chapters of it on this show here in particular. And they've gone over really, really well. This is a poem, a Halloween-themed poem. And it actually fits into the universe of The Widow's Game. And it takes place right before the first person buys the farm in the book. Yeah, I said buys the farm. That's what happens. We've got great stuff on here. So the first three pieces of work you're going to hear are from Maddie Von Stark, the great Carrie Lipp, and a new author named Joseph Matulich, who's written a pretty cool story for us this evening. So sit back, relax. I'll pop in every once in a while to make sure you're still holding on. And let's listen to some kick-ass Halloween spooky.
Belial's Halloween Foretoken.
I smiled at the children in devil masks, gushing from door to door, screaming trick-or-treat, becoming an in-unison roar. How I would like to see the raven now, and all his nevermores. I laughed to myself as they skipped like jacks, jumped over jack-o'-lantern dripping wax, then ran down to the next house, dreaming of their plundered fat candy stacks. On the corner of 14th at the edge of town, I picked up the pace as darkness began to bear down. Under the silver moon, I felt his shadow descend. He dropped his chin upon my shoulder, stopping me utterly with clenched hands. The thistles of his shark teeth brushed my blonde milky hair, excoriating my scalp in a fury, leaving tiny lacerations of his ivory snares. He turned me to face him and I looked away. He wanted to play games, but I didn't want to. Not today. His unusually long fingers traced my chin down the collar of my black wool coat until my neck was exposed. Then he tapped his nails on the cradle of my throat. He stuck a long sharp fingernail between his lips. "Not so happy to see me today, my Von Stark," he whispered in my ear. "I start imagining the ways you could desire me." He looked up at me with rapacious eyes as I took a step back. "Bee, I will never desire you." He cocked an eyebrow and spread a Holocaust grin. "Happy Halloween, my Miss Maddie Holiday Von Stark." He bent forward and kissed my hand. Instantly, my fingers flowered into ice. "We will be seeing a lot more of each other soon." He tipped his hat and completely vanished when the clouds covered the moon. I pulled up my collar and drew deep breaths with a coughing hiss. "A lot more soon, my love," the wind whispered in a swish. I ran up the driveway to the old Von Stark place, up the stairs and locked the door. Somewhere, something grinning chuckled. "Nevermore. Nevermore. For I have found my lost Lenore."
Broken Glass.
Knock, knock. I opened the door and stared at the kid in front of me. I was expecting him. Pre-teen or early teen, I didn't know. He wore sunglasses, a fluorescent green hat, backwards and cockeyed, a LeBron James basketball jersey. Heat, not Cavs. Mismatched black and white socks pulled up halfway to the knees. Air Jordan shoes. I didn't know much about fashion, but I picked it all up easily. He was a walking billboard. "Hey man, shit happens, right? My bad. Can I get that back?" The kid said his insincere words a formality. "No," I said. "Get off my porch." His jaw clenched, tightened. His mouth opened. "Now," I hissed, and he turned and walked away. And I'll be damned if the same things and worse didn't start happening more often. Vandalism, sometimes the windows, sometimes the trees, sometimes my garden. But he never came back to my front door. I kept an eye on that spoiled, entitled little shit for the next few years. I didn't want to harm a child, not even a shitty one like that. So I found out when he turned 18. Planned a little birthday party. I had 5 years to make my plans and 5 years to change my mind. But the pranks and the vandalism never stopped. But my drinking started again. And I saved all the empty bottles. I snatched him on his 18th birthday, drugged him, taped a bag over his head, and threw him in my trunk. We went for a little ride. I knew a quiet, abandoned field and forest about an hour away. For some reason, it had stayed that way ever since I was the kid's age. I used to grow pot out there. Never got caught. Never had a close call. That land was like a loner in high school. There, but forgotten. For the last few years, I've been bringing my empty bottles out here. And I'd usually bring full ones, too. I like to drink while I prepped. First thing I did was dig a pit, maybe 5 feet deep and 20 feet around. Kind of like a swimming pool, but a circle, not a square. A big project, but when you chip away at it, not so bad. Then I lined the bottom with broken bricks and jagged cinder blocks so the bottles I tossed in shattered. Dead center, I put in a nylon tube, like one of those little tunnels toddlers like to crawl around in. Like you see in gerbil cages? We are a strange species. I reinforced the tube with wooden planks so the weight of the glass wouldn't cave the tube in. I didn't know if the glass would cut right through the nylon or not, but it didn't. Maybe I got lucky, or maybe science forbids it. Doesn't matter. I spent the rest of my time out there at the pit drinking and smashing bottles. Breaking glass is fun. I brought in load after load. Mostly beer and wine and liquor bottles, but food jars too. Whatever I could get. Every few loads I brought some rock or water, softener, salt, and dusted the layers of broken glass like I was pitching pennies in a fountain. I made a few wishes too. The pit was open to the rain, and in time, a crusty white film coated the jagged pieces. I'd been working on it for years, like an artist, I guess you could say. And considering what passed for art these days, and maybe this was pretty damn good. Call It Justice, by Clyde Havenshaw. Dressed in coveralls, gloves, a mask that covered everything but my eyes, and composite toe boots, I stripped the kid, a man now I suppose, at least according to the law, and threw him over my shoulder. I threw him in the little nylon toddler tunnel like the pissant child he was. Pulling the tunnel was the biggest part I worried about, but it came out fast as a spent dick. With a sound like television static, the glass spilled onto his body, burying him to the neck. Sparkling waves of pain in the moonlight. The sound, the pain, or both, didn't wake him up. Glass crunched underfoot as I carried the ragged tunnel to the edge of the pit. I dropped it and picked up 2 beers. I walked back to the center of the pit, twisted one, and dumped icy coldness on his face. His face lit in unwelcome shock for just a second as he jolted into coherence. Then the sensation of salt-crusted glass cutting his skin kicked in. He screamed and didn't stop. I watched him struggle, enjoying the moment, when his comprehension kicked in and he realized he was buried neck deep in broken glass. He started to fight. I'll give him credit for that. He struggled to raise his arms through the glass. "Help me! It burns! It burns! It hurts! Somebody help!" he shrieked as I placed his hat backwards and cockeyed on his head. Eventually, his arms came up in a mess of blood and flecks of skin. Torn pieces of muscle hung from the bones. And I couldn't imagine how heavy that glass was and how hard he fought to free them. But he got him out. I remembered the salt and shuddered. He stared at me, raised his torn red arms, dripping dots of skin and clotted blood plopping onto layers of glass. I took off my mask. "Here's the ball you put through my window, you little shit. After I tasted your attitude that day, I stared into the glass from my broken window and got a crazy idea, I said, finished my beer and smashed it in the pit. He stared at my hand gripping the baseball. I threw it. His glazed face gaped, and I could see that his almost dead eyes wanted to live. It's a long way to that ball, but if you get there, I'll let you go. With wild eyes, he screamed and pushed his hands down into the glass, trying to force his lower half out of the glass. His palms tore. His naked body slowly slid up in shreds of flesh, body coated red with blood. Pieces of skin dangled, some even flapped, and I saw salt-coated glass embedded in the raw flesh beneath his skin. But he didn't quit. He bit his bottom lip off as he focused through the pain, and it shocked me to see that he was going to actually make it to that baseball. Good thing I had only told him that I'd let him go. I didn't say I'd get him to a hospital. And we were in the middle of nowhere.
Foot in the door.
Harry stood stock still in the half-open doorway with a 12-pound select sampler of Garalmo's meats in his arms. 30 feet behind him, his truck idled in the driveway, its engine providing power to the chest freezer in the bed. No more than 12 feet in front of him, something was feeding behind the couch. Harry was pinned between the two. Even a slight shifting of his weight was enough to make the porch's floorboards creak beneath one foot, though not loudly enough to announce his presence. He couldn't see the snarling thing, but Harry heard noises of ripping flesh and tooth on bone. A single small leg, its foot wearing a pink and white sneaker, swung back and forth in time to the animalistic sounds. It had been strictly against company safety rules for him to push in through the door's front door when he found it hanging open. But he was way behind on his sales quota this morning and willing to take a few risks. No success without risk, his trainers always said. Get your foot in the door, they said. The worst that could happen is that they say no. Something much worse seemed to be happening. Now, half his body was in the door of the Suburban split level with the muscles of his forearms burning with the effort of holding the box of frozen steaks absolutely still. Harry thanked God that he hadn't called out to the house before he heard the snuffling and chewing and saw the blood on the walls. Harry stood there for what seemed to be a lifetime. He had to remain motionless to avoid drawing the thing's attention. He had to remain silent. He had to pee. Something that had once been a hand wrapped around the ankle of the sneaker-clad leg. Harry saw the play of tendon and bone through the holes in its gray-blue skin. The leg was pulled out of sight for several moments of excited gnawing and tearing. When the limb was dropped back to the floor, the calf muscle had been ripped off at the bone like a discarded drumstick. The blue and red LEDs in the sneaker's sole flashed like fireflies. Harry did not scream, as reasonable as that seemed at the moment. He bit his lip and sucked it up, as he had always done in the face of rejection. Then a breeze came up and caught the door, blowing it fully open to bang against the wall inside. Oh, fuck. The sounds of the unseen things feeding stopped, to be replaced by a wheezing, angry cry. Something gray and filthy and hungry, the wreck of a human being, rose to stand behind the couch. It moved towards him, much faster than a corpse should. Harry bolted, throwing the steaks into the living room in the hope that they would somehow distract the hungry thing that was already crawling over the couch. He realized that was pointless, no matter how tender, marbled and carefully aged Geronimo's meats might be. They weren't anywhere near as full of warmth and blood as he was. And that was Maddie Von Stark, Carrie Lipp, and Joseph Matulich. Great stuff. Up next we have Jesse Saxon, Jerry McKinney, and Georgina Morales. I always wanted to do the whole Spanish Morales, you know. I've been working on rolling my R's. She probably doesn't even say her name like that. It could be a fail. Let's get back to being spooky, shall we?
Eli.
There was a late night knock at the door. Paul and Gina locked eyes in their living room, just as Paul got up to see who it could be. As he walked down the hallway to the entryway, three more knocks erupted from the door, accompanied by a trick-or-treat. Paul glanced out of the peephole to see a small child in a skeleton costume. He opened the door and the child spoke again.
Trick or treat.
Paul couldn't tell if the child was a boy or a girl, from the gravelly, almost frog-like voice or the papier-mâché skull mask. The child held a plain white pillowcase open and glared up at Paul.
Sure, yeah, hold on a second, said Paul.
Who is it, Paul? Asked Gina.
Trick-or-treater, honey. Where did you put the candy bowl?
At this hour? Trick-or-treat was over hours ago. It's in here.
Sorry, kid. Just give me a sec to get the candy, he said, and slightly closed the front door to go back to the living room.
What's wrong with this kid's parents?
Gina said as Paul came in.
I don't know, honey. He's out there alone, probably just going to every house in the neighborhood to get as much candy as he can. You know how kids are, he replied.
Paul took the candy back to the door and pulled it back open.
All righty, he said before stopping to see that he wasn't talking to anyone.
The kid in the skeleton costume was gone.
The stoop of their townhouse was empty, and the cold night air of autumn was the only thing making a sound as it crept through the street. Paul took the candy back to the living room and told Gina how the kid had left.
Must have got tired of waiting, she said.
Just as well, Paul said.
He sat back down, and Gina went back to her book when another knock came from the door.
Guess he's back, Gina said.
Paul took the candy back to the door and opened it to see again no one on the stoop. Paul stepped outside and looked up and down the sidewalk, but saw no one. He thought for a moment about how hard the prank kids must be laughing at him, wherever it was they were. He went back to the door, and as he began to close it behind him, he heard the froggy voice creak out,
"Trick or treat!"
again. Paul turned on his heels and saw the small child holding out the plain white pillowcase.
"Take as many as you'd like," Paul said, offering the bowl of candy.
The small child tilted its head as it looked at him. Paul looked through the eye holes of the mask and made eye contact with the child. He couldn't help but notice that the child had the palest blue eyes he'd ever seen. So much so that they consumed his concentration for that moment.
"I'm sorry, I'm just here. Take the whole bowl. Do you live around here?"
The tiny skeleton shook its head.
"No?
Well, then how did you end up here?" The skeleton shrugged its shoulders.
"Are you lost? What's your name?"
"Eli,"
the skeleton whispered.
"Do you need help, Eli? Where's your mommy or daddy?"
The skeleton shrugged its shoulders again. Paul invited Eli into the foyer of the townhouse and shut the door behind him. He told him to wait in the entryway while he went into the living room to get his phone.
"What's going on?" Gina said.
"The kid is back. I think he's lost. I'm going to call the police and see if they can help him find his way home," he said.
He turned from the living room back to the hall toward the front door. As he was about to dial 911, he noticed that Eli wasn't in the entryway anymore.
"Eli?"
Paul asked and peered around the front of the house.
"Oh, God, don't tell me you lost him again," Gina said.
"Seriously, Gina, did you hear the door shut? I didn't." Just then, both Paul and Gina heard footsteps running along the second floor of their house, and then a door slamming shut.
Eli, this isn't the time for games. It's very late, and we need to get you back to your parents. There was no answer. I'm calling the police, Gina said. Paul reluctantly went upstairs. He turned on all of the hallway lights and every light thereafter in every room. Eli was nowhere to be found. They continued to search the house until the police arrived, and still yielding no sign of the small skeleton known as Eli. The two reporting officers became skeptical of the call, and when more pressing issues came over their walkie-talkies, they told Paul and Gina that the kid probably freaked out and left, but if he turned back up, to call 911. An hour after the police left, Paul and Gina went to bed. It took a while for them to fall asleep, but soon enough, they both did. Paul was sleeping well until he heard the floorboards under their bed creak and bend. He reached for Gina's hand and found it very cold. He looked over at her and saw Eli's skull mask on her face and dried blood on her throat. When he turned back to his side of the bed, the small child leapt onto his chest, sinking claws into his skin. It was no child at all. Its face was twisted and its nose was upturned like a bat's. Its skin was gray and leathery, with pointed ears.
"Trick or treat,"
it said. Paul gasped. The creature pounced and began to rip at Paul's face with its claws, all the while laughing as it killed him and screaming,
"Trick or treat!
Trick or treat! Trick or treat!"
Night Sound.
I can hear them moving in the dark. I close my eyes and try to drift away to the point of unconsciousness, the moment of uncaring. Sleep evades me still. They are in the walls, you see. My wife would tell me I'm imagining things, that there was nothing moving around in our home except a few ants on the counters and a small spider continuously building webs in the corners of the bathroom. These are no bugs. They whisper. Not loud enough to make out what is being said, but voices nonetheless. Muffled sounds of a quiet conversation amid the insulation and wiring of the master bedroom wall. Every night I would bury my head into my pillow until the pounding of my heartbeat echoed throughout my skull. The thunderous crashing of blood rushed in my ears. I'd lift my head to escape my body's own noises, breathless, gasping for air, and be greeted with the murmurs of the empty room. The accursed walls. I need to sleep. God, I need to sleep. How could she not hear? I wanted to shake her awake and yell, "Are you deaf?" But she'd slumber beside me, her breathing mixed with light snores. How I would envy her. Many nights I'd watch the swell of her chest illuminated by an outside street lamp, filtering in through the curtains and counter breaths. A slight gleam would dance upon the folds of her satin nightgown. I embraced these things, the normalcy of life, and kept my mind off the sounds. Until the scratching began. I had to concentrate to hear it at first. No more than a modest scraping on the backside of the wallboard. I sat up at the edge of the bed and listened. My ears have become fine-tuned to even the smallest sound. It was growing. Standing up, I silently crossed the throw rug on the hardwood floor. A misplaced step had my toe bump the molding and the scratching stopped. I held my breath with my ear turned to the wall. Not a single sound did I make. My wife's breathing seemed so loud from the bed. She turned on her side and the sheets played a symphony of notes sliding across her skin. Issuing a moan, she cleared her throat before falling back into the dream world. as if they could no longer control themselves. The things on the other side of the wall giggled with glee. My heart hammered in my chest and I stumbled backwards. My jaw dropped open. I ran to flick on the light and looked out the bedroom door to the other side of the wall. There was nothing there. Yet the laughter continued. I beat on the accursed spot with my fists, yelling out, "Shut up, damn you, be quiet! Leave me alone!"
"Alone?"
Something chortled with a deep, gravelly tone.
"There's always room for more."
After a hideous round of laughter, it was silent once again. I closed my eyes and screamed, then felt claws grip my arm and putrid breath on my face. I stared into the face of madness.
"Welcome,"
the spirit bade. Paralyzed in fear, as it pulled me closer to its gaping maw, I fell into the darkness. We talk among ourselves to pass the time. I know you are awake. I can hear you. We're in your wall, you see.
The Weeping Lady.
Ezekiel grabbed the saddle and fought to mount his black and white horse. A thud to his left told him Samuel was having no less trouble.
"Told you we should have stopped after the third. Damn it, I can't get my foot in the stirrup," said Ezekiel, thinking of the long way home ahead. "I hate moonless nights. I can't see nothing."
Samuel got on his feet again and mimicked his friend's position. With a jump, Ezekiel climbed the animal and grabbed the reins. Victory shined in his eyes.
"You better get your shit together, 'cause I promised Belinda I'd put her to bed myself. She'll be mighty disappointed if I don't get home soon."
"Belle's sleeping, you fool," Samuel chuckled and held onto his horse's neck. The animal shook its head, upset at its master's careless ways.
"I reckon you'll be dealing with the missus now."
Ezekiel directed the steed to follow the earthen path outside the town's bar, scolding himself for losing track of time.
"I guess taking a shortcut suits us fine," Ezekiel said.
Samuel looked at his friend, haunted.
"But it goes into the woods by the cliff. You rather take your chances with Linda?"
Samuel hung his head. The last time he'd gotten home this drunk and this late, he'd slept on the couch for a week. Any later, he might have to ask Ezekiel for a room. The forking on the road opened before them. A couple of feet ahead to the left lay a narrow path not many dared traversing, but that could save them at least a half an hour. Samuel followed Ezekiel into the forest. He shuddered. They advanced in silence, startled at the sound of every crunching leaf. By Ezekiel's calculations, they should be halfway home, at the point closest to the ravine.
"You don't believe in those nonsenses, do you, Sam?"
Gone was the drunken slur of Ezekiel's voice, replaced instead by a slight tremor, as if cold.
"What, the weeping lady?"
Samuel swallowed hard.
"Pfft."
A wail like a banshee pierced the night, echoing on the walls of the ravine a few feet to their left. Ezekiel spurred the horse to a trot, though he couldn't figure out what the woman had said. A second cry filled the air.
"My babies! Where are my babies?"
"It's her," Samuel whispered, now trotting at Ezekiel's side. "Don't call her attention and keep your eyes on the ground. Let's get the hell away from the gorge." Ezekiel knew the legend well. The weeping lady had been a single mother from town. Abandoned by her lover and scoffed by the community, she had drowned her three children on the river, the bottom of the gorge, then killed herself. Unable to find rest in death,
she wandered the forest looking for her kids and making random men pay for her lover's rejection. But Ezekiel had always laughed at the town folk's superstitious minds. Not even the advent of wondrous things like television had diminished the horror the woman's story had caused in them. Ezekiel never thought one day they'd be proven right.
My babies are lost!
The weeping reached them from afar. Terror painted Samuel's colorless features. He hauled the reins too harshly. The horse reared, squealing. Tension rolled into the forest like a tide, and the night turned cold. A soulless laugh reached them, carried by the wind. She's here! Samuel yelled and broke on a gallop. Ezekiel followed suit. Legend said the farther the wraith's lament, the closer she was. Unable to see Sam through the dark, Ezekiel crossed the forest, tree limbs scarred his face and limbs. The wailing persisted in the distance.
You left me.
Ezekiel changed directions many times trying to get away, until he could no longer tell north from south. He slowed down. From behind the closest trees, the back of a woman's white dress revealed itself. She had the ethereal quality of an angel. His vision blurred and a cloud muddied his thoughts. Ezekiel followed her. To hell with Belinda and Sarah. He wanted this woman. He forged ahead, and time stopped having meaning. A minute or an hour later, his mount refused to heed Ezekiel's commands. Move, you stupid! Ezekiel focused on the steed as its hoofs sent a rock trundling down the verge of a cliff. On the uppermost corner of his eyesight, the lady floated in midair. Ezekiel lifted his eyes, and the apparition in front of him spun. A horse had crowned the feminine silhouette, screeching with the fury of a thousand souls condemned to hell. Darkness swallowed the edges of Ezekiel's world. He feared losing consciousness. The terrified horse turned around and galloped in search of salvation. Behind, the preternatural cries echoed louder and closer. When the voice rung in Ezekiel's ears, his heart fluttered and the steed's charge increased. Closer is farther, Ezekiel repeated to himself. Come on, buddy, we've almost made... He flew forward as the horse's front hoofs tangled on the exposed roots of a tree. The animal fought to get up, but exhausted, it crumbled. Lying on the floor, Ezekiel saw his left leg twisted at an awkward angle before pain exploded in his brain. Between tree trunks, the eerie white garbs hovered. Out of breath and sweating, Ezekiel looked around for a place to hide. His hands stumbled upon train tracks. On the other side, candlelight shone through the windows of Samuel's house. Ezekiel crawled, biting his cheeks as he downed the throbbing agony in his leg.
My babies! Where are my babies?
He slapped the front door. Before passing out, on the edge of the forest, the lady stared at him with hatred. Her face was beautiful and delicate. Her hair floated in a matted nest.
Look what you made me do!
At her feet, three tiny corpses lied scattered on the ground. When Linda found Ezekiel at her door, his hair had turned white. He was feverish and delirious. He died a week later, but not before relating the story to my grandmother, Belinda. Samuel's body was never found, and my grandmother never again set foot inside the forest.
And that was Jesse Saxon, Jerry McKinney, and Georgina Morales. Great stuff. Thank you very much for sending those in. The next three writers are probably three of my favorite writers. They're all cool. At least one of them is incredibly funny and a little terrifying. I'm not talking about Chris Brown. I'm talking about Katie Jane. Katie gave us, for season three, probably one of the coolest zombie stories ever. And she doesn't disappoint here. We also have returning poet Stephanie Witowicz. I love her work. She is a kickin' poet, and her work is just really phenomenal. I'm glad she was able to give me some stuff for this episode in particular. And the last of the trio for this time around is one of my pals, the amazing C. Brian Brown. He's a really, really good writer, and this is a very powerful piece, and I let his stand alone. It's the first time I've done that on this show. So sit back, relax, or, you know, hit pause and, you know, go get a drink or something. I don't know what you do. Are you doing spooky stuff? Are you listening to this podcast while you're handing out candy to the kids? Well, you better hurry up and get back. Here we go.
Love will tear us apart.
I rolled over on my side and let my fingertips brush the cool skin of Sam's back. I traced her panty line, but she didn't stir. She was still angry from our fight a few days before. I'm making breakfast. How's bacon? She didn't answer. I got up and smoothed the blankets on my side of the bed. I shivered and checked the thermostat. 58 degrees, just like always. Looking over my shoulder, I saw her hair was covering her face in a thick red veil. I decided to let her sleep. The phone rang. Hello? Ben, this is Craig Sorensen. How's Sam doing? My brain whirred. Oh, Craig, she's still not doing well. She hasn't been able to eat in days, and she sleeps a lot. Well, I'm glad she's getting rest. I really need her to either come in or get that FMLA paperwork done. She's going to be out of sick days this week. I'll let her know, Craig. We'll talk to the doctor and see what we can do. I put the phone down on the counter and busied myself with making breakfast. While I waited for the bacon to fry, I went to the hall closet and reached in the back for an old jean jacket I hadn't worn in 20 years. The pocket was stiff, and I pulled out the cigarettes I kept stashed there. Sam hated that I smoked, so I did it on the sly. The smell of frying bacon masked the smell. It was a guilty pleasure. Ben! I jumped up and ran the tap to put out the cigarette. I would have to be quick. Plate in the middle of the tray, tea in the top right corner, silverware on the left. Stopping at the bedroom door, I took a deep breath, then opened it. Sam, I know you hate bacon, but I just don't know how anyone can hate bacon. She lay stiffly in the same position I'd left her in. I sat the tray on the bedside table and brushed her hair out of her face. I saw she was still wearing the ruby-colored necklace I'd given her after our last fight. You haven't eaten in days. Please try. Helping her to roll onto her back and sit up was difficult in her weakened state, but I managed to get her propped up. You look better today. She stared at me, glassy-eyed. Craig called to check on you. They really miss you at work. Nothing. I thought about the fight, looking for something that I could make positive or apologize for. Apparently I'm stuck in some sort of monotonous routine, and at least that's what she screamed at me. Even when you're sick, you're beautiful. A knock at the front door interrupted me. I gave her smooth cheek a chaste kiss and shut the bedroom door behind me as I walked down the hall. Mr. Grant? I opened the door. Two sheriff's officers stood on the front porch. Their badges glinted in the sun. Good morning, officers. What can I do you for? Mr. Grant, your wife's boss called and said she's been very ill for a while, and we just came to ease his mind. Check to see that she's okay. Of course. She'll be angry. She doesn't have any makeup on. Can we come in? I stepped aside and led them down the dark hall. I heard one take a sharp breath behind me. Awful cold in here, Mr. Grant. Sam likes it cold. She's not feeling well. I opened the door and moved to the bed. Sam, some nice officers are here to see you. Dispatch, we got a situation here at this welfare check. Send a wagon, please. I heard the radio crackle behind me. She's not that sick. No, but you are, Mr. Grant. I'm gonna need you to come with me. I shouldn't leave. Sam? I love you, Sam. We'll keep her company, Mr. Grant. Don't worry. I looked back at her. She was grinning shyly. The radio crackled again. No hurry, dispatch. She's been gone a while. Gone? I thought she was just pissed off.
There's a corpse in my mirror.
There's a corpse in my mirror, but no one else can see him but me. The rest of you, the watchers, the wishers, you don't walk with the moonlight like we do. You don't howl at the stars and count the years like we do. And I was lost for so long, buried amongst you, the living, walking around like a bag of hot flesh, when the chill I'd been looking for, when the death I'd been searching for was 6 feet beneath the very spot where I stand. He wasn't always there, wasn't always lingering in my reflection, standing behind me, in front of me, next to me, inside of me. But there's no denying him now. It's been too long, and I'm as much a part of him as he is of me. We're two halves to the whole, and I'm the Eve to his Adam, the apple to the snake. Bound by blood, by bite, by teeth, and I wear his mark on my neck, like a crimson choker fashioned by the kiss of an Iron Maiden. So all of you, the meat sacks, the blood baskets, the skin suits, know that I am taken, know that I'm real, and know that this time, I'm very much alive.
Damsel in distress.
Love me. Kill me. Drain me. Fill me. Don't leave me here in the dark, in the shadows where I'm alone without the touch of the devil's hand. Kiss me. Bite me. Hold me. Cut me. Don't leave me here in the grave, in the ground where I'm 6 feet away from your neck. Call me. Hear me. See me. Feel me. Don't leave me here to die, to wither away and starve. Bleed me. Embrace me. Resurrect me. Pray for me, for I am your mistress, your damsel, who's very much waiting in distress.
Vampire Noir.
Give him shadows, a black and white canvas painted in chiaroscuro moonlight, and he'll come to her in nightmares, walking through her open bedroom window, his black cape drowned in darkness and on fire against his milk-bathed flesh. He moves at the speed of her fear, sulking in the corners, creeping through the quicksand thoughts in her head. Is he demon or angel? Lover or fiend? Her feet touch the floor and sink into the chill draft that hovers over uneven floorboards, the wood petrified and splintered, grabbing at her skin as she walks towards death, the rising action of a bloodlust fueled by power and weakened by dawn's morning breath. She wonders if it's better to slow the film down and watch it scene by scene, or embrace the climax, run to the Dracula denouement, and die as the leading lady with the bloodstained lips and a necklace made of bites.
Swing line.
This is my confession, my absolution. Believe or disbelieve, it doesn't matter. I believe because I know. I know because I was there. I could have stopped it, saved them. Death whispered, tick-tock, 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 and waited for me to do something. That's the thing about death. It's never really waiting, but creeping. Always slinking up on people, talking to them when they least expect it. In most cases, death wants to be stopped, wants someone there to prevent it. Why do you think there's so many accidental deaths? I didn't make the bomb, didn't put it in the building or detonate it, but I knew it was there. Knew when it was going to explode. A time existed when I could have stopped the bomb from entering the building. But I didn't. All the classic signs were there, withdrawn, sullen, rebellious, drugs. She was all of those, and I missed it. No, it's not true. I ignored them. This was normal, right? Just a phase she was going through. She was smoking pot, drinking raspberry vodka, writing poetry filled with death and blood, and listening to heavy driving music with screeching instead of singing. She said they spoke her language, that they knew her future. Hell, it's all pretty cliche, right? Until it's not, I suppose. Then they're making homemade explosives and texting their friends about targets and dawn of a new age or some shit. We're supposed to trust them, right? Believe that they're on the right path, that we've given them the tools to make good, solid decisions. Something might have come along and changed her mind. Someone might have talked her out of it. She might have realized life was better than she thought. A bus might have hit her. I just don't know. No one could know. I should have called the cops, but she'd have hated me. I couldn't deal with that. Not after what happened to her mother. It changed her. It changed us. I was trying. I don't know, trying to keep us together, to make life work for us again. It was our life, and I fucking wanted it back. Yeah. People died. I'm sorry as hell about that. My wife died years ago, leaving me to do this shit alone, but people die, right? All the time. And it's not fair. What could I have done? I let her become. Tell me, what would you have done? And that was C. Brian Brown, preceded, of course, with three poems by Stephanie Watovich and the great, great K.T. Jane. I love the payoff on K.T.'s. It's a good one. So, still listening, eh, kiddies? We've got a few more to go. I know we're rounding the hour mark here, but we're going to run it like a Kettle Whistle Radio episode and just keep recording until we stop. I'm just kidding, Dave. I would like to remind you that you are listening to The Wicked Library right here on the beautiful Society 13 Podcast Network.
And I'll do all sorts of plugs and stuff for all 13 of these guys at the very end. Coming up next, we have two of my favorite Canadians simultaneously. That didn't sound right. And a new writer who, he was late sending in his submission, but they were so cool that I did not have time to record them, but the librarian decided to take a swipe at these. So let's listen to Mandy DeGate, Andrew Miller, and the great Lydia Peaver.
Inviolable.
The haze of Valium helps, but the pain is always there. Even still, she doesn't make a sound as the scissors clamp closed, slicing through her lips and revealing two near-perfect rows of white chiclets. Tears stream down her cheeks as the shears tug her smile away from her face, the severed flesh falling to the ground with a sickening splat. She quivers in silence as a hot flat iron is pressed to her skeletal grin. The smell of burning flesh permeates the room, and the sizzle of cooking meat resonates in her ears. The pain in her mouth is forgotten as the straight razor slashes into her breasts one at a time. Her nipples harden as the sharp blade cuts through her soft skin like butter. One by one, the mounds of yellow fat are thrown onto the floor beside her once pouty smile. The pain is unbearable. But still, she endures it. She has to. She doesn't make a sound as the searing metal of the iron cauterizes her chest wounds. The blistering heat of the iron staunches the flow of blood. She gnashes her teeth together as her once beautiful breasts are charred and burnt. Her chest heaves and hitches, and she is allowed a moment of reprieve. The constant throb of pain reminds her she is still alive. She watches wide-eyed as the carving knife slides up between her legs, the pointed tip catching her most sensitive area, and a bead of blood oozes from her swollen clitoris. She almost whimpers as the 7 inches of sharpened blade is buried into her vagina, but she stays strong. With a flick of her wrist and a quick downward slice, two holes become one. Blood pours between her thighs, saturating her long legs and the ground around her. She wants to scream, but doesn't. She squeezes her eyes shut and tries to focus on anything but the excruciating pain when the hot curling iron is inserted into her. Lubricated by blood, the golden shaft slips easily into her widened vagina. She longs to pass out and forget what's happened, but she toughs it out. The curling iron is pulled free and set on the counter. Sizzling pieces of flesh still cling to the metal like mini strips of bacon. But she doesn't give them a second look. She trembles as she turns to the mirror, careful not to slip in the pools of blood that cover the bathroom tiling. She wants to scream as she sees her reflection in the mirror, but she doesn't. She will not give them the satisfaction. She has screamed too much already. Happiness blooms from deep within her as she realizes beauty can be destroyed. No one will ever rape her again. The pain she has caused herself is nothing compared to the shame she once felt.
Limericks by Andrew Miller. There once was a woman named Letty, who wielded a sharpened machete. She encountered a thief, but the meeting was brief, for she hacked him to human confetti. There once was a werewolf named Dinah, who hailed from North Carolina. She said, and I quote, "I'll rip out your throat if you end with the obvious rhyme." Someday.
April Fools, you little dick. The sneer plastering Al's smug face was all it took to end that conversation. His bully friend stepped in close for a better view of John, curled in a ball at their feet. Looking up, the gang was ringed in the fluorescent light flickering down from the school hall ceiling. All John could see through tear-rimmed eyes were four giant, blurry assholes. Tears were not the only thing making them blurry. For what was likely the third time this month, they had tripped him in the hall. Not only tripped, but adding to the insult, one would swat his glasses away. Sometimes another would punch his books from the bottom so they exploded into his face before cascading onto the floor. Last time, one of them had jabbed under his ribs hard enough that he had aches for 3 days. If he had not told the teacher it was Al and his friends drinking under the stands by the field, it might not have been this bad. For sure, they annoyed him before. They tripped him in the hall for 3 years straight. They slammed into him when he walked past, maybe 1,000 times. No reason, no apology. It may not be forgivable, but it was pretty much forgettable. Since he'd caught them drinking, though, they were getting worse. On the floor, he wiped water, not tears, out of his eyes. The hot, embarrassed prickle of blood in his cheeks was already draining back. His body was getting used to this. A hot rush of hate. Heart rate calming to a slower simmer once he realized it was just them. Those dicks. Those assholes. Again. This time, with his fingernails biting red brands into his palms and teeth clenched against shouting, "You cocks, you dicks, leave me alone!" He did wish they were dead. If only all four of their heads would explode for no apparent reason other than being too full of hot air. Giant plumes of gray matter, broken bowl shards of skull, clattering into the walls, then skipping across the dull luster of polished floors. Globs of blood, eyeballs, snot, and their hair smashed up in the air and raining down on the headless bodies like the books that hit his face and tumbled onto the floor. Arterial arcs of red spraying quick half-circles all around as four torsos, limp and lifeless, fell in a big pile of useless football player fat. If only his brother were there with his baseball bat. If only his brother weren't dead. John gained footing slowly and pushed himself up with his hands. He straightened his belt and shirt like he always did. He retrieved his never-broken glasses from the hall wherever they had ended up. He did not listen to what they were saying. He was too busy imagining the heft of a 10-pound sledge in his hands, hearing in his mind that sick whomp of heavy metal slamming into the sick pulp of what used to be a body, what used to be them. Feeling the reverb up his arm as he trailed the wooden handle up an exposed spine through that rent cavern of guts he has made of them. If only they really were a pile of dead at his feet. If only he were beating them again and again with a sledgehammer. If only he could greet them with a shotgun someday. It was the end of the school day, as it always was when they attacked. So he went straight home. Months passed before he saw them again. The summer had been unremarkable. Passed with a few weeks at the cottage, piles of books to read, and 2 poetry reviews written for the magazine his mother worked for. A summer of salads, lamplight reading, and long walks in the forest with his camera. Boring and lazy. More reading than writing. Just the way a summer is supposed to be. School had been about 2 months in when he saw them again.
It had not been hard to convince his mom to let him switch schools. He had told the truth, and she had understood. At the farmer's flea market in August, when he bought the heavy crowbar, that was when he had lied. When he saw them again, he had followed them into the park. The four of them had no idea he was there. At the liquor store, while they bought a giant bottle of Black Label whiskey, none of them had seen him. So predictable, they would go to the same place they had 1,000 times. Under the stands, by the football field. He walked slowly back to his house, and was walking back toward the school a half hour later. They did not hear a thing as he inched closer. Quiet breathing, no rustle of fabric. He was careful and deliberate. Only one of them looked up when he stepped between them, crowbar raised and ready. "Happy Halloween," said John. And that was Mandy DeGate with her thoroughly uncomfortable episode. You know, you'll have to send me mail if it was as uncomfortable to listen to as it was to record that one. Some really cool horror-laced limericks from Andrew Miller, and one of my favorite writers, period, Lydia Peaver. Just killer stuff, and we are down to 2 more segments, kiddies. Next up is another one of my favorite writers, and honestly, all of these writers are fantastic, and I really hope you're enjoying the special. I know you're going to dig this one. If you are an aficionado of this show, you have heard Jessica McHugh's name thrown around. Nothing but good things to say about Jessica, of course, even after meeting her. I asked Jessica if she had any flash fiction, knowing full well that she probably did, because she writes constantly. She, some people are constant readers. She is a constant writer, and I don't think I've ever met anyone with her work ethic for writing. She's the delivery chick. She always delivers the goods. Let's sit back, relax, and listen to Jessica McHugh.
The Jennifer Girls.
Henry Young had a fondness for blondes, especially the bleached ones. His height of sensuality was in watching a girl strip away the brunette until she hit the flaxen attitude underneath. That's how it was with Jennifer. She'd been his first, and every girl since. The way she'd rejected him was mirrored in the blondes who crossed his path, compelling him to win their hearts. He always failed in the end, but at least he derived pleasure from it. Their bodies slack, his golden treasure collected, he left to seek another Jennifer who could love him back. Henry was convinced he'd find her one day, a girl who wouldn't run, who wouldn't call the police or chase him away from the window with a pair of dull scissors. He was surprised by how many girls had dull scissors lying around. How did they expect to defend themselves against someone whose scissors were as sharp as Henry's? They never could, which is why he also had a fondness for dull scissors. He wished for a girl who wouldn't reach for a weapon when she saw him, but he couldn't deny his enjoyment in the search, in the chase. Fear played with women's bodies in the most wonderful ways. Every heave, every shriek, every jostle of fright and flight incited Henry's hunger. He tried to keep their hair clean as he stopped Jennifer's struggle, but there was a certain allure in watching blood soak into blonde. Those clippings never entered his collection, but he snipped them off anyway, if only for how heavenly they looked scattered around a bald head in a rosy halo. The newest girl, the one from the tavern, was more strawberry than his usual Jennifer's, but Henry was willing to make an exception. He'd been watching her for a month,
growing more enraptured as he recognized the subtle differences between the bartender and the off-hours girl. She was soft at work, always polite, but through the window of her living room, she seemed softer still. She danced more than she walked, and sang more than she spoke. It solidified a truth he'd always known. Blondes were the prettiest girls. She sang along to her favorite movie, unable to hear him break the lock on the back door. Entering the room, he pretended he belonged there. Her fear was immediate when she spotted him, but she didn't run until he withdrew the scissors. She didn't get far. He grabbed her by the ankle, pulling her down, and dragged her into the kitchen as he whistled the same jaunty tune recently blasting from her lips. She thrashed until the scissors got a taste of her. One quick slash stopped her flailing, but she wouldn't stop crying. It was rather unattractive the way her face scrunched up with each ball. He tried to ignore the ugliness by repeating, "Blondes are the prettiest girls." But it didn't work. She wasn't who he thought she was. She wasn't pretty at all. So there was no reason to keep her around. Her hair was a different story. Ugly as the girl was, her blonde mane would make a fine addition to his collection. "Pretty, pretty, pretty," he clucked, pressing the scissors against her scalp. He balled her hair in his fist, but it felt strange. Dry and wiry, even plastic. All it took was a tug to realize why. The wig pulled free, revealing a short crop of dark brown hair. When Henry threw it to the floor with an angry huff, the brunette laughed at him. It was meant to mock, and Henry was certain it would increase his rage. But it didn't. Instead, his heart quickened in delight. The girl was so pretty when she laughed. Even with her true brunette out in the open, she was more beautiful than any blonde who'd come before. The scissors froze her smile, and the blade stretched it up her cheeks. Looking down at her permanent crimson grin, Henry realized his lifelong mistake. The prettiest girls didn't have to be Jennifers. They didn't have to be blondes. The prettiest girls laughed at death.
Where the apple shine won't reach.
Brenda lay on her bed, 3 pages to go in her book. Her face was moist with tears and she was biting her lip. 7 books in, this was to be the last book for the Dark Gift romantic vampire series. The absolute last, according to the publisher, in spite of the 2 previous sequels that were also to have been the last. But this was to be the absolute last one. It was even called Last Rites. Brenda had waited patiently for this one book for nearly 3 years, and she had gone to the midnight sale date. Midnight, Halloween night at Holmes & Bernard's bookseller and music superstore, invitation through lottery only, please, thanks so much. She stood in the small line that had begun to form the night before Halloween, but she was 3rd in line, thank goodness, and ran to the display and grabbed her book, $34.99. No sale price for the early birds. She paid for it and bolted for her car so she could begin the long night, day, and night of Last Rites in her apartment, all alone with the curtains closed, and not stop reading until she was done. Then she would take a shower. The book itself was mammoth, nearly 1,500 pages long, not counting the 45-page author's introduction. "I love each and every single sick one of you," the grateful author concludes. The other books for Dark Gift ran from 300 to 675 pages throughout the run of the series. This one, though,
Brenda was very intimidated by its sheer size, but was also delighted because she knew it would be worth the wait to read it. She knew that there was so much to get out of this book, and how could it be anything other than huge? Nearly 24 hours later, here she was, weeping and nearly done with the entire series. It was beautiful. It was a dream how wonderful the words were so well crafted. Helen, the story's heroine, had spent the bulk of the Dark Gift series madly in love with Kirk, a young-looking vampire she met in high school. They have adventures and high romance with other vampires and human friends as well. But then there came the werewolves, ghouls, one tried to kill, then eat Helen. Mummies, it was awesome. They went to Egypt for a class trip. And finally, Count Dracula himself, in this, the final book. Dracula, who was actually Kirk's uncle, tried to get between him and Helen, and Dracula nearly succeeded. But Kirk, ever resourceful, stopped a very bad union just in the nick of time. But then Kirk was nearly destroyed by the ancestor of Van Helsing, Dracula's old enemy. But Helen, in her latent psychic powers, found in Book 3, Head Trauma, came to the rescue. And that was only up to page 750. There was more, a lot more, leading up to the last three pages in this sprawling series, where Helen and Kirk marry and where Helen agrees to finally accept Kirk's dark gift. As she turned the last page, Brenda's eyes went wide. She let out a very tiny squeak. She quietly closed the book and sat on her bed for several minutes. She felt fulfilled somehow. She shuddered slightly and sat up. She wiped her face and sighed. She was hugging the book as if it were a small child. A thousand thoughts ran through her mind. She wanted to cry. She wanted to kiss. She wanted. Most of all, she wanted. She stood up and went into her bathroom. Resting the book gently on the toilet tank, she stepped into the shower and turned the cold water on strong. Oh yes, she wanted. 10 minutes later, she stepped from the shower and toweled off. She grabbed the book and padded into her bedroom. Tossing the book oh so carefully on the bed, she opened her vast closet and chose what she'd wear tonight. It was nearly midnight and still Halloween. There was always a little fun to be had, and she had so much pent-up energy from the book, she couldn't contain herself. Wouldn't contain herself. She wanted to explode and giggled. She felt naive and older than her years. She knew love like Helen's and Kirk's couldn't exist, but oh, she wanted it so bad. It was so beautiful to her. The stories had touched her in ways she couldn't have ever imagined. And now she would go out and hope in her heart of hearts that maybe, just maybe, there would be something in the world for her. She smiled and went out of her front door to find something. Something she wanted very much. Anything. 4.5 hours later, Brenda sat on her bed crying. Her face was buried in her hands, and she sobbed hard. No, there wasn't a love like Helen and Kirk's. There wasn't anything close to it. No instant attraction, no doe-eyed romance or romantic adventure. No pale-skinned, beautiful waif, and certainly no glittering supernatural hero. There was what there always was. Anger. And hate. And emptiness. Just a void that could never be filled by anyone or anything. She was alone. All alone. She stood up angrily and walked across her room. She kicked the young man lying crumpled in a heap and unconscious on the floor. He gave a small muffled yelp. He slowly came to and began to weep. Where? She kicked him again. Shut up, Brenda snarled. Just shut up. She began to pace, glaring at the young man. He was looking up at her now, petrified.
Please, look, what did I...
Brenda stopped and knelt down to him. She grabbed his neck and pulled him closer. His eyes went wide as her face turned into a snarling rictus of sharp teeth that extended from ear to ear.
What did you do? You didn't do anything! Absolutely nothing!
The young man started to scream, and Brenda sank her teeth quickly into the lower half of his face. He struggled briefly, but then was quiet again. She fed, and fed well, but cried the entire time. When she was done, she pulled herself up off of the floor and went into the bathroom. She looked at her face. Vampires weren't heroes. They weren't romantic. They didn't sparkle in the sun. They didn't fall in love. They didn't have fabulous adventures, and although they could see themselves in the mirror, they were not beautiful. They were most often covered in blood and left a trail of corpses behind them. She hit the mirror as hard as she could. It shattered and she nearly screamed, but held it. The books. She wanted to destroy them. She ran into her room and picked up Last Rites off of her bed. She was going to tear it in half. Brenda looked at the cover. She looked at it carefully. And she wanted to cry. She sat down for a long time until finally she opened the book and began to read. Vampires weren't a lot of things. Nothing like they were in the Last Rites books. But they could still dream.
And that last story, in case you were wondering, yeah, it was one of mine. I wanted to be on my own show, and it takes place on Halloween. I want to play too. Sorry. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed all of the stories on the Halloween special. Man, we've almost hit the 90-minute mark. Gotta get the hell to bed. It's like 2:15 in the morning right now. So, if you've heard this whole episode in one sitting, you're awesome. And if you're going to go listen to it again, you're even more awesome. I'm going to have in the show description links to where you can find all of the authors that have appeared on this episode. And I'm going to name them all. If you want to Google them or go to Amazon and pick up what they have to offer you beyond the story you've heard tonight. And I'm talking about Maddie Von Stark, Carrie Lipp, Joseph Matulich, Jesse Saxon, Jerry McKinney, Georgina Morales, K.T. Jane, Stephanie Watovich, C. Brian Brown, Mandy DeGate, Andrew Miller, Lydia Peaver, and Jessica McHugh. And me. I'm there too. And on behalf of all of the authors this week, and Maddie Von Stark, who's pulling double duty as well on this episode. Until next time, maybe keep the lights on. This is Nelson W. Piles. Happy Halloween, everyone.